Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. This episode covers a recent presentation I attended with Susan Godwin, the 2012-2013 Oxfam Nigerian Female Food Hero. This event occurred at the Yeehaw Farm in Duncannon, PA, and was sponsored by Oxfam and the Women in Agriculture Network. Susan joined everyone in the morning as part of the farm tour, broke bread and ate lunch with us, and then spoke about her experiences as a farmer. At the beginning of the day, she joked with us that touring the farm was important so she could see how white people farm, though the entire tour wound up being a dialogue discussing the differences between her style of farming and Western agriculture. But the differences weren't really in the way that she farmed, but in the difficulties that she faced. As a smallhold farmer, particularly a woman in Nigeria, she began the discussion with a bit of background on herself. A mother of five children, before she began farming, she and her family moved around following her husband in his capacity as a policeman, traveling from place to place, through town and cities, for work. Along the way, however, Susan, the daughter of farmers, felt a need to return to her village and to the land to farm. And so she and her children left her husband, returned to her village, where she began raising peanuts, yams, maize, millet, and cassava, in an integrated fashion where all the crops grew intermixed in one field together, not in a monocrop of separate stands. As I understand it, she initially was not very successful, being able to raise enough crops for food or to sell for money, but not enough to comfortably do both. While struggling with this, she heard about a program from Oxfam about successful farming techniques and community development. Initially discouraged by her neighbors as a waste of time, she went through the program anyway and implored them later to go take the course. Still rebuffed, she took the knowledge from the class to heart and began farming in earnest with the new techniques for productivity and also to increase the value of the products from her harvest. Though I don't remember the specific numbers between her first year and second year when she implemented these techniques, but she did say that it more than doubled her production in that first year after connecting with Oxfam. She was now able to feed her family and raise the money needed to rent more land and invest in equipment to diversify her yields. The primary product she spoke about, which all of her equipment that she bought seemed directly related to, was processing ground nuts, or what some of us would call peanuts. Her first machine was for shelling the nuts, which had more value when shelled, which led to a bump in income, next allowing her to purchase machines to produce oil from the nuts, and then to press the remaining oilless meal into cakes. The oil and cakes are sold separately at an even higher value than those original unshelled peanuts. Now she has multiple machines for each of these processes, which enables her to expand her holdings to 7 acres of rented farmland in this most recent year, about 3 hectares, with the hope to expand again in the next growing season. Along the way, she's been able to hire some of the women in her village to help her with her business. No longer do the members of her community see what she spent the last several years building as a waste of time. Now they want to know more, and they seek out Susan's advice to build their own businesses and free themselves from the cycles of poverty and need. But I can't present this path as one of ever onward and upward. Susan faced a number of persistent problems along the way. For me, the most striking were the issues she dealt with from her community. I've always had an interest in sociology and the way human groups interact, and though I'm far removed from the path where I would have studied that, that interest stuck with me, and that's why I wound up paying the closest attention as she spoke about these social problems. The first fact impressed upon us by Susan was that 70% of the food raised in Nigeria is done by women with small holdings, often less than an acre or half hectare, to perhaps, like Susan, 3 or 4 hectares, 7 or 8 acres, but widely unsupported by government or community. These women farmers go at it alone, raising what they can for their own families and selling the remainder. But in this process of selling the food, it often is being sold to middlemen who will buy a whole crop, but at prices that are much lower than could be garnered by selling directly to consumers. But the middlemen are almost a guaranteed source of income, as opposed to the potential of not making enough at market. And the farmers are stuck between that persistent, constant income offered by the middlemen versus more money that they could make if they took a risk. and from what I've learned from talking with social workers and other people in communities in need, when someone is stuck at that level of subsistence, just making enough to get by, long-term planning becomes more difficult, and weighing the benefits of risk versus reward becomes nearly impossible. You just want to take the action that you can to make it to the next day, because it's something that you can count on and that provides short-term security and takes away the day-to-day stress, even though more stress and dismay waits around the corner if the slightest, smallest interruption breaks that feeling of security. But it's hard to build that kind of security as a farmer because land's expensive to buy in Nigeria. So very rarely do the farmers own their land, but instead they lease it from someone else. From what Susan said, often the farmers who are looking to rent land will wind up being given the least fertile ground to farm by the landowner. And then as the farmer puts their work and labor and sweat equity into it to develop it and get the fertility back up, once that first season of really good productivity occurs, the landowner will kick the farmer off, take that piece of fertile land back, now that it's been repaired, and farm it until it will no longer support the crops that they want. And then the process starts all over again, and they'll lease that land back out to a farmer in need, and those who have will be able to take from those who don't. Another complication for this is that the land that's available for rent is often in small plots here and there. The 7 acres that Susan farms isn't contiguous. It's not all together in one place. They're broken up into parcels all around her village. As she said, some are a few kilometers to the east, a little bit more, a few kilometers to the west, and so on, requiring her to spend a great deal of time traveling from plot to plot in order to farm. So these small-scale farmers are paying money to rent the land, taking a lot of time to travel, but then they also hire labor for various tasks. Someone to prepare a field, to aid in bringing in the harvest at the end of the season, to make heaps with the yams so that they can cure, getting someone with a truck to come out and pick up the harvest, to take it to buyers or the market. Every step along the way, there are places where there are outlays of money, and often the farmers are being taken because of untrusty workers. Susan recounted numerous cases of the expectations of the laborers who are hired for work. Often, before they'll come out, they'll demand to be paid up front, and then never show. Or they'll ask for wages at the end of each day, and once they work a few days and have some money in their pocket, they don't come back. They have what they need and they move on. Or they'll do as little work as possible to be paid, or ask for a meal from these women farmers, and once delivered and eaten, will claim that they're too full and tired to work, or now that they've eaten, they feel sick, and that they will get back to the work the next day, and then wander off and never return. She also spoke to the need to contend with thieves who come and steal the farmers' foods at the end of the season, particularly since so few people own trucks and the crops for everyone in the community mature at around the same time. The farmers need to hire someone to come and transport the harvest back to town, when it's the same kind of difficulties as with the hired labor. They may not show up at all, or when they do, because they're so busy, going from farm to farm to farm, making so many pickups and deliveries, that often farmers are forced to stay in the fields to protect their crops. Susan said that she was fortunate in her time as a farmer that she only had to sleep with her harvest once, but knew of many others who have done so also, many of them multiple times, that her experience is far from unique and common for many of her fellow farmers in the community. But now that she's made it through the growing season and contended with untrusty workers and thieves and lack of security from her people picking up the harvest, once it's all back, people such as Susan, who are growing these businesses and helping their communities, face additional challenges within their own villages. Originally, when Susan began looking for people to hire to run the machines to process her peanuts, no one would help her. She asked around and asked around, but again, everyone thought that she was wasting her time and didn't want to waste their own time. But eventually, one of the women came forward and began to work with Susan. But rather than paying the woman in money directly, which a husband could take, which Susan said was fairly common for a husband to control a wife's economic livelihood, Susan instead paid her with peanuts that were too small for the shelling machine to shell. Everything that fell through the machine went to the woman. She could then collect them as she worked each day, take them home, shell them by hand, feed them to her family, or sell them at market, or, once Susan had her other equipment, process those small nuts into oil and cakes. Though this may slow the flow of money and economic growth for the women, doing so keeps the money where it needs to be, under the control of the woman who earns it. Without a regular payday or direct transfer of money from Susan to her employees, it's harder to notice patterns and see when the money comes in to take. It's one small step towards economic equality for the women through this process. And this worked well enough that now Susan has three women working for her, running the machines and helping with her farm business, and share in her success, because Susan works openly with them to help them grow and make decisions that are useful to them and their families so they can get ahead and lift themselves up by their bootstraps and make a difference in their own lives. And though she has three employees now, as for that first woman Susan hired, when no one else would work her machines for her, members of Susan's tribe told Susan that this worker didn't deserve to work anymore, now that Susan was successful, because this worker was from a different tribe. And they told her that everyone working for Susan should be from her own tribe, so that these tribal peoples could share in Susan's success. But Susan didn't listen to them. She refused to replace that first employee with anyone else. And I'm very thankful to report that while Susan spoke to us in Pennsylvania, that woman who took a chance to operate a shelling machine being paid literally with peanuts, when no one else would, now manages Susan's business when Susan is away on tours like this one with Oxfam, or when Susan is doing business elsewhere in Nigeria, to help spread this message and idea. And so the cooperation and sharing within the community continues to expand and grow. And as for Susan, she was happy to report that this business has allowed her to put her children through university and pay for their education. And her last daughter is either just starting or will be starting at the university very soon. Listening to what I've shared here, a second-hand account of the struggles and successes of Susan Godwin, a Nigerian farmer, what can you take away from Susan's experiences, her problems, and solutions, and apply to your own path? Where are the places you see to make small changes for great good in what you're doing? How can you use this one incredible woman's story to change the world? Once you've pondered those questions and perhaps listened to Susan Godwin's amazing story again, I'd like to recommend a book for you to read. That is Save Three Lives by Robert Rodale. I've mentioned this book before, but when it comes to providing food security for more people, the message contained within is vital when combined with the possibilities and techniques of permaculture and food forests. We can create systems of growing food in ways that are atypical to what many people might expect. In a sense, hiding food from the kinds of people who would come and rob Susan and others of their harvest by making it something they don't know to look for. Agriculture and gardening that can be further integrated into communities so that crops exist everywhere in ways harder to find, take, or destroy. As we develop our knowledge of edible species, annuals and perennials, and begin breeding them for improved flavor, those weeds can be a viable source of food or income for someone in need. We truly have the ability to build a better world. And there will be more thoughts on that from my next guest, Chuck Marsh, a permaculture designer, nursery person, international worker, and one of the people who helped found the Earthhaven Eco-Village. Until then, take a few minutes and stop by thepermaculturepodcast.com/support to see how you can help the show with a donation or to spread the word. I'll talk to you again soon. And please, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.